All right, here we are. Lawyer talk, off the record, on the air. Going to do a breakdown today. Clancy. Everybody's been talking about the Clancy trial, and I have not yet, but I'm going to now. It's as a criminal defense lawyer, it's sort of fascinating. I love watching these trials unfold. I've got my own opinions on it on like my real world side, but on the legal side, it's pretty fascinating. And there's a couple nuances I want to cover. I'm going to sort of start at the end and work backwards. Everybody's asking me in my personal life, what's going on? Is the jury going to be hung? What instructions? I'm just going to break it all down. There was a case in the U.S. Supreme Court, so I'm skipping around. Forgive me. I get criticized for it. I don't care. Allen versus the United States. It's a Supreme Court case, 1896. I didn't realize it was that old until I just looked it up. But basically, it approved what we lawyers in the criminal realm call the dynamite charge. And the dynamite charge is usually a situation where the jury has deliberated for a period of time. They come back and say, "Judge, we just can't get it done. We're deadlocked. We're never going to agree. I hate that guy. That guy hates me. And that girl over there, she's a pain in the ass. And we're not getting along. No verdict. It's never going to happen." And usually, the first time that happens, the judge will say, "Yeah, go back there and keep deliberating." And the jurors look at us like, "Why are you making us do this?" So we send them back, and the judge sends them back, and they keep deliberating. And I can imagine what happens. You folks on the jury, please comment if you've ever been on a jury and gone through this. I never have. But I imagine the jurors go back and say, "What the F is going on? We just told them we can't find a verdict. We can't reach a verdict. And now they're making us try anyway." It's got to be frustrating. And then almost often we'll get another knock on the door or another ring of the bell or the little light goes on. They have a question. And the jury will come back and say, "Look, we told you once. Now we're telling you twice. We still can't reach a verdict. It's never going to happen. That guy over there is still a weasel. And that woman over there, she won't. This is horrible." So the judge now often will say, "Yeah, let me give you another instruction first." And the other instruction is usually based on this Allen case. And it's something like, it's a long instruction, but it's something like this: "I'm going to ask you that you continue your deliberations in an effort to reach a verdict or to reach an agreement upon a verdict and dispose of this case. And I have a few additional comments I would like you to consider. This is an important case. The trial has been expensive in time, effort, and money, and emotional strain to both the defense and to the prosecution. Should you fail to agree on a verdict, the case will be left open and may have to be tried again. Obviously, another trial would only serve to increase the cost on both sides. And there is no reason to believe the case can be tried again by either side any better or more exhaustively than it was done here. Any future jury must be selected in the same manner from the same source as you were chosen. And there is no reason to believe that the case could ever be submitted to 12 men and women more conscientious, more impartial, more competent to decide it, or that a more clear evidence would ever be produced. If a substantial majority of your number are in favor of conviction, those of you who disagree should reconsider your doubt as those of you who disagree should reconsider whether your doubt is a reasonable one, since it appears to make no effective impression upon the minds of the others. On the other hand, if a majority or even a lesser number of you are in favor of an acquittal, the rest of you should ask yourselves again, and most thoughtfully, whether you should accept the weight and sufficiency of the evidence which fails to convince your fellow jurors beyond a reasonable doubt. Remember at all times that no juror is expected to give up an honest belief he or she may have as to the weight or effect of the evidence. But after a full deliberation and consideration of the evidence in the case, it is your duty to agree upon a verdict if you can do so. You must remember that if the evidence in the case fails to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant should have your unanimous verdict of not guilty. You may be as leisurely in your deliberations as the occasion may require, and you should take all the time which you feel may be necessary. I will ask you now that you retire once again and continue your deliberations with these additional comments in mind, to be applied, of course, in conjunction with all the other instructions I've previously given you." And I'm sure I didn't read the exact text of the Clancy charge. In Boston, they call it a 2E something or other charge based on their case up there. But it was probably something like that. I'm sure the jurors, when they heard that, they were sort of rolling their eyes thinking, "Come on, that's not going to change our minds," because everybody still believes that everything else they believed about the case. Interestingly, I've not heard the split. A lot of times the judges will ask, "Well, can you give me a hint here? Is it 10-2? Is it 11-1? Is it 6-6? Where are we deadlocked? What's the deal? Sometimes the judge will ask those questions. So then the judge sends this jury back, and they still, after how many days now, five, I guess, maybe longer, don't have a verdict even after the dynamite charge. Now, Boston, or the jurisdiction up there, it might be Massachusetts, actually, has an interesting rule. And their rule is basically after the dynamite charge. So the first time the judge comes back, or the jury comes back and says, we can't reach a verdict, judge sends them back and say, keep trying. Second time, gives the dynamite charge. The third time, the judge has to do something differently. This is unique to Massachusetts. I practice in Ohio. We do not have this rule there. But the judge will say something like, look, do you think it will be helpful if we send you back for further deliberations? And if they all say no, I think the judge has to discharge them. Now, the procedure may be a little more nuanced than that, but that's generally what the judge is going to have to do. So I think everybody's sort of waiting on bated breath right now as to whether the jury's going to come back with a verdict. And if they don't, are they going to be willing to continue to deliberate? My money right now says mistrial based upon a hung jury. I could be wrong. I've been wrong plenty of times before, but I think that's where this is going. And otherwise, the jury will come back with a verdict. Now, what happens if it's hung and there's a mistrial? The judge or the prosecutor has to make a decision. The prosecutor gets to decide, do we want to retry the case? Same charges, just like before, and try again. There's lots of famous cases where this has happened. I've been involved in several. Or do they want to try to cut a deal? Often that happens. So, you know, and that usually is directly dependent upon what the split is. You get a jury that's 11-1 for acquittal. I think the prosecutor is going to be more likely to come to the table with some sort of plea offer. You get a jury that is 11-1 for conviction. Yeah, maybe the incentive on the prosecutor side isn't as strong to offer some sort of plea bargain. And then the defense, obviously, the same way. I will tell you, I hate retrying cases after a mistrial. It's sort of like anybody's ever written a paper, drafted a letter, sent a text that got deleted, whatever it is. When you have to redo something that you've already done, it sucks. I hate it. I've had, back in the days before we had cloud storage, it would happen every now and then that you would hit the wrong button at midnight on a college paper or something and gets deleted. And that's how I feel about retrying cases. Like, crap, I got to do this again. But apparently the defense lawyer, who's done a phenomenal job by all standards of defense work. I mean, the guy just is a phenomenal cross-examiner, has a good grasp of what's going on, sticks to the story of what he's trying to accomplish. He's been on the courthouse steps saying, I'll start tomorrow. Well, I mean, which is the next question. Will it really start tomorrow? If we get a hung jury today, will they start next week? I've had judges say that. I've been involved in several cases where we hang them up and the judge says, okay, we'll see you guys tomorrow morning or Monday morning if it's a Friday, and we'll pick them again. I don't know in this case if that'll happen, and here's why. There are a lot of witnesses here, and usually when you have experts, it's not so easy to get schedules lined up. So often when I have a case involving experts, particularly those from out of town, we have to schedule months out because experts, whether they're for the defense or for the state, they're busy. You can't always find people that will provide opinions and review documents and review cases, and you have to get them scheduled. So it may not be practical to say, all right, prosecutor, all right, defense, get your experts. We're going to go again next week. It's probably going to have to get pushed out and scheduled and it'll be months down the road. And in the meantime, of course, anything can happen. The other nuance to the Clancy case I want to talk about is this insanity defense. And insanity is an interesting beast. You know, the general standard for insanity is based on a case called Manaughton, M-N-A-U-G-H-T-E-N, I think. And we all sort of learned about this in law school, but the Manaughton rule, it goes way back to English common law, I believe. But the Manaughton rule basically says, it recognized in that case that if the defendant doesn't appreciate what he's doing and doesn't know right from wrong, doesn't know that his conduct or her conduct in this case is wrong, then insanity can be a defense. There is another insanity defense or a definition of insanity that emerged called the irresistible impulse, which is basically somebody just somebody had an irresistible impulse to commit the crime. They couldn't control it. And it was just too much to handle, so they committed the crime. Most jurisdictions, and I think Massachusetts, are on the Manhattan side, and by and large, the irresistible impulse is the minority at best, if it even exists anywhere. There's a great movie, but I love talking about movies. There's a great movie, by the way, that sort of highlights some of this, and it's called The Anatomy of a Murder, George C. Scott, Jimmy Stewart. It was a sort of a country lawyer up in the UP in Michigan, I think Munising. He's a fisherman and a lawyer, and this guy comes in from out of town with his girl. They go to the local watering hole, and I think either somebody's hitting on the girl or she hooks up another guy. Turns out her man kills the paramour, whatever you would call him. And then Jimmy Stewart's going to argue insanity, and they talk about irresistible impulse. They talk a little bit about right from wrong. They bring in the heavy hitter from down south. George C. Scott is the prosecutor. I won't tell you how it ends, but check it out because it is a good movie, old black and white movie, but a good movie talking about insanity. But anyway, back to Clancy. What's interesting about the Massachusetts rule that I've heard other people comment on is that it sort of reverses the burden of proof. In criminal defense, we have a list of things known as affirmative defenses. And one of those affirmative defenses in Ohio anyway, and I think most jurisdictions, is not guilty by reason of insanity. I'm asserting this defense. Did I say an affirmative defense of not guilty by reason of insanity? Another affirmative defense you might think about in certain terms is self-defense. And some states have something called voluntary intoxication. Ohio doesn't. Or diminished capacity. So those are affirmative defenses. And what I mean by that is how the burdens of proof are laid out. The prosecutor has to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's elements of this crime. In every other jurisdiction except for Massachusetts, I think, it would go something like this. Miss Clancy over here committed murder. That is, she purposely took the lives of her children. I'm summarizing the elements. I'm sure there are more nuance to it. But the old common law definition is the taking of one human life by another with malice aforethought, which in modern days is purpose. So you purposely killed these people or your children. Then typically the defense would have to say, all right, if the state has proved those elements, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, that would be the instruction. Then you must consider the affirmative defense of insanity. Now, beyond a reasonable doubt is generally what the proof measure is for the governor, for the prosecutor, for the main elements of the offense. And then you shift over, and in Ohio anyway, affirmative defenses typically would carry a lesser burden of proof of something like preponderance of the evidence. So if you could picture the scales of justice, beyond a reasonable doubt, you're tipping over, spilling whatever's on the scale all over the floor. Preponderance of the evidence, you just put a feather on one side and weight it down just a little bit. That's preponderance of the evidence. So some of this becomes sort of a logic game. But anyway, assuming the elements are proved, the state has proven the elements by beyond a reasonable doubt, then the jury is asked to consider the affirmative defense. But in Massachusetts, it's a little different. The nuance of this is the prosecutor has to, as soon as the defense raised the insanity defense, the prosecutor now has to disprove it by beyond a reasonable doubt. And this is a nuance that, frankly, I didn't know that existed in anywhere, let alone Massachusetts. But it makes it a little bit more difficult. So now the state has undertaken the obligation not only to prove the case, but disprove the defense beyond a reasonable doubt. A little backdrop. Ohio used to have a rule about self-defense that made our burden of self-defense to prove it beyond or to prove it by preponderance of the evidence. Now the law has changed and it sort of falls in line with most other jurisdictions that the state has to disprove self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. So now insanity up in Massachusetts is like that. And it would not be like that in Ohio, and I doubt it's like that in most jurisdictions. So we'll see. People have been asking me what my prediction is. I think this jury's going to hang. I don't know all the nuances of what the lesser and possible lesser included charges are. It would not surprise me if there is a conviction, either at this trial, if it doesn't hang, or a retrial, it'll be some lesser version of murder, maybe manslaughter, some other type of, dare I say, compromise, but something lesser. Anyway, that's my Clancy breakdown for the day. As it develops, I'll probably do some more. So lawyer talk off the record on the air, talking Clancy till now. By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.